Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Dan, I have seldom seen a better title to a book than the one Mitch Kuzi chose for his. Now, I quote, "Why I Don't Work Here Anymore. It's all about toxic employees." Dr. Kuzi, welcome to our program. I'm going to call you Mitch from now on, but I had to get the doctor in. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your book and why you decided to write it.
Great. My name is Mitch Kuzi. I'm a professor in the PhD program at Antioch University. I'm a corporate psychologist. This is my sixth book, my best book, and why I decided to write it. Let me tell you a little story. I was working in an organization about 20 years ago, and I worked with a toxic individual. She wore a special perfume. She was ultimately fired, highly toxic. 10 years later, I walked into an elevator, smelled her perfume that she wore, and got sick to my stomach. I had this incredible visceral response. I said, there must be something to it. And then when I was interviewing to become a professor at Antioch University, one of my colleagues, Dr. Elizabeth Holloway, said, Mitch, have you ever thought about writing a book about toxic personalities and doing a research study? And I started getting sick to my stomach again. So I said, there must be something to this. So my last book called Toxic Workplace that I wrote with my co-author, Elizabeth Holloway, and then this one, Why I Don't Work Here Anymore, and the subtitle, The Leader's Guide to Offset the Financial and Emotional Cost of Toxic Employees. Interestingly, it's not just about the visceral responses. In our research study, we found that it affects team performance and the bottom line. So there's something to this, and I decided to write this sequel book that's a real how-to about what you do about this pervasive problem in organizations.
You know, Mitch, I seldom bring up, but we a couple of weeks ago, we had a guest on who also wrote a book about toxic employees. I thought after she was on, and then when I saw your book, which, by the way, I found extremely, well, I thought it was funny because I saw so many people in my lifetime in what you were describing. But I think we kind of kept those people under wraps. But now I think we're beginning to realize just how toxic they are to good business. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. It's good business to do something about this issue. And let me give you some statistics. In my book, I've got what's called the Toxic Cost Worksheet, where I've taken mega research studies, integrated that into a formula, and all someone needs to do is integrate two things, the number of employees in their organization and the average compensation, and voila, you find out what toxic people are costing your organization, anywhere from 4 to 6% of total payroll cost. And that doesn't even include individuals who are less committed to the organization, individuals who show up for work, but they don't work very hard because they're victims of these toxic individuals. This is where sexual harassment was in the 70s and 80s. It needs to be brought to the forefront, and I'm hoping my book, Why I Don't Work Here Anymore, does that. Interestingly as well, our research, and it was with 400 leaders throughout the United States, found that 51% of the victims of toxic individuals are likely to quit. What we also know from other research studies, other researchers have found that 12% of the victims have quit. In healthcare, 31% of nurses quit as a result of being a victim of a toxic individual, whether or not that victim is a direct report, peer, or boss.
Well, let me interrupt you. How do you identify a toxic individual? Then I'm going to turn it over to Dan.
Okay. It's a great question. Two perspectives. First of all, it's counterproductive work behaviors that there's a pattern that debilitates an individual, a team, or an organization. More specifically, three categories. Individuals who shame other people. They humiliate other people one-on-one or in public. That's the first category. Second is they engage in passive hostility. They are able to get their aggression out in passive ways. Third, they sabotage the work of others. Those are the three categories that we found in our study of over 400 individuals. They are Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. They often know how to, what I say in the book, kiss up to those with power, but knock down to those who don't have perceived power.
Amen. Dan, it's all yours.
Yeah. Dan, it's all yours.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by the concept of your book because it would seem that these toxic people have great skill in hiding their toxicity in order to get the job.
Well, that is an incredibly loaded question, and I've got a number of responses. First of all, what we found in our study, and by the way, 94% of the 400 people in our study said in the past 5 years they have worked with a toxic person. So first of all, the problem is pervasive. Secondly, interesting that you brought up a perfume story that was similar to mine, but here's the fascinating thing. Most toxic individuals are clueless about the impact of their behavior on others. So subsequently, that is one of the reasons that without a systems approach to looking at all the things that contribute to the toxicity, feedback often fails. In fact, that was the number one strategy that leaders told us failed more than any others trying to give feedback to a person who was clueless about the impact of their behavior on others. But the other really interesting thing that you pointed out, Dan, is this. In another study, they found that when a customer, because you're a business program, when a customer witnesses a toxic interchange between two employees, 80% of them will not come back. Fascinating case. About several months ago, I fly a lot, and I was waiting to board my plane, and the pilot came out, and I'm not going to mention the airline, the pilot came out and chewed out this ticket agent. The person next to me said, you know what, I'm never flying this airline again. Amen. It impacts the business, and your program is about business and recalculating business, and this is something that leaders need to look at, leaders need to start doing something about.
Do you think that the leaders that you're talking about, and you said in your answering Don's question, you said that these toxic individuals have a unique ability to ingrain themselves to the senior management of companies, so that the senior management, when they interact with that toxic individual, that person isn't toxic with them. They're only toxic with you.
And if you tried that senior manager, and if you tried to tell him or her, these are the things that are going on with this individual, they are likely to say, well, you know, I know she's demanding. I know he really wants people to be at their best. He's really bringing out the performance of the team. But what the senior manager isn't realizing is that they're causing less organizational commitment to the organization, and people are exiting the organization again, the title, Why I Don't Work Here Anymore. It is pervasive, Dan.
So let me take it just a little, go very contemporary in today's news headlines and ask you the question. Some say overreaction to, others say not enough reaction to, what's going on in sexual harassment in the workforce. And well, I'm curious where you put that approach, both, and now we have some cases of women harassing men. Where do you put that interchange of sexual harassment or sexual domination of employees? Where do you put that in the toxic environment?
Well, first of all, when we're talking about toxic behaviors, we're talking to the threshold of not approaching physical abuse, because we have laws against physical abuse, but we don't have laws against toxic behavior. Now, taking it to the contemporary scene that you just mentioned about the sexual harassment that's going on, as a corporate psychologist and as a researcher and someone who has become an expert in toxic personalities, what I'm looking for is a pattern. And you know what? I'm seeing a pattern out there. A number of people are coming forward and saying, this is going on. I'm not one to pass judgment. All I can tell you is, if there's a pattern, there's a high probability that abuse is going on.
So that Don and I have talked about this particular issue in the past. And so let me play devil's advocate to put you in a different spot. There are some people think that this is this particular issue is a pendulum that has swung one way to the point that there was absolute freedom to harass and assault women and children and men. And now that the pendulum has swung past the midpoint and back way to the opposite end. And so I'm curious, as a psychologist and somebody dealing with work psychology, is that in that issue that we're dealing with today in the workplace, whether it is in a particular workplace where you work, not you personally, but a client of yours might be working, it is in the minds of people. Is that in and of itself having an adverse impact on what's happening in the workplace?
The negative approach to that is, yes, it's in the mind of individuals, so that could be negative. But the positive also with that is it's in the minds of individuals, and I've been through this previously, someone is speaking, I've been through this, and now this gives me an opportunity to speak up. The gate has now been opened. And I like to think of it as the positive pendulum, that this has provided an opportunity for people to say, enough is enough. Stop the madness. And that's exactly what I talk about in my book, is please stop the madness. These people are getting away with hell. I'm going to even make it more difficult. Here's an interesting dilemma with some of my clients all over the world. Some of the toxic individuals may be your highest performers, and they're reluctant to fire those individuals. But what is happening is that they are bringing in momentary money or yearly money, but what the key leaders in the organization aren't seeing are the number of individuals that are exiting. The cost of replacing an entry-level individual is 50% of their salary. The cost of replacing a mid-level person is 150% of their salary. And the cost of replacing a high-level, highly specialized individual is anywhere from 300 to 400% of their salary. We cannot stand still any longer. Even high-productive individuals are causing havoc in an organization and causing financial expenses. Here's another interesting dilemma in healthcare. One of my clients with a head surgeon said, you are putting our practice at risk. I don't care if you are bringing in the most money right now. it's right now until there's an impending lawsuit, et cetera, because of your toxic behavior. Also interesting in healthcare, anywhere, it depends on who you read, anywhere from 60% to 80% of nurses said that the most significant issue for patient safety in healthcare are what they call disruptive or toxic individuals. And 15% reported patient death as a result. You know, before I read these statistics, Don and Dan, I always thought patient safety and concern for the patient was an issue of competence or incompetence. Certainly there's some of that, but there's shaming that's going on and people won't speak up. I did a keynote address several years ago, 500 people in the room, non-healthcare group. I related these statistics. And a gentleman raised his hand and said, just last night, my wife told me this story. She is a nurse, and she said she could not read the medication order. And rather than go to the physician who was likely to bite her head off, she went to 3 to 4 other individuals to interpret the order.
Hmm. I'm reluctant to say we know, but there are examples of the God complex in special surgeons and certain kinds of doctors in their professions, and that's relatively well known. But what do hospital administrators and corporate executives are they beginning to understand the magnitude of what you're talking about, or are they still ignoring it?
No, they are. I'm going all over the world now, helping people understand the magnitude of the problem, and I help them in huge ways by helping them look at what they need to do to change their culture so people will speak up. And I'm looking at in small ways. Some of the small ways is let's try to avoid also bringing these toxic individuals into the organization. Here's another story and a strategy that I talk about in my book. I call it the recruiting cue sheet. Here's a true scenario. A potential candidate, senior vice president, was traveling across the country for a top interview job. And she landed, and the hiring manager couldn't be there for the first 10 minutes. And subsequently, the administrative assistant met her at the airport. And the administrative assistant is asking, well, tell me about your flight. She said, yeah, it was a good flight. This is a really exciting opportunity for you. Do you have any questions for me? No. And the administrative assistant appropriately thought, well, she's probably nervous. It's a big interview. Until the hiring manager showed up. And all of a sudden, this potential senior VP became ebullient, energetic, asked open-ended questions, engaged the administrative assistant. The administrative assistant is scratching his head saying, what the hell is going on here? Well, what's going on is you've got a potential toxic individual who is going to kiss up and knock down. Here's the strategy. It's a very simple strategy. We all have team interviews, and we all know, you know, we invite a number of people to be part of interview. But here's the method. Think about those individuals who the candidate is likely to interact with, whom you never get data from, who are not part of the interview. Maintenance people, drivers, cafeteria people, clerical people, receptionists, and go to those individuals ahead of time and say, you may or may not have an opportunity to talk with this individual. But if you do, here's a little worksheet I have for you, and I want you to answer these three questions, these five questions, such as, did the person give you eye contact? Did they engage you in conversation? Does it look like a person who would live out the values of our organization? And then go back and collect those data. That will reduce the probability of bringing in a toxic individual. Very simple strategy.
You anticipated my next question, because I was looking for those questions.
Well,
that you
after that, I need to anticipate these things.
Right. Don, back to you.
Well, we could go all day. We've got a few more minutes, but I'd like to go another direction, because I know I would like to know how to deal with the toxic individual. You know, as we've been talking, I've been going through my mind, and I remember three or four people, three of whom were my bosses, and they were absolutely, you described them to a T. They toadied up and did a lot down. But how do you deal with a toxic individual?
Okay, that's a great question. I'm going to answer the question first indirectly. One of the things that we discovered is that there's often what we call toxic protectors and toxic buffers. Toxic protectors have a special relationship with this individual, and subsequently he or she allows that individual to get away with bad behavior. The toxic buffer is the individual who is well aware of their antics, but what they do is they don't want to rock the boat, and so they'll take leadership responsibilities away from that individual, place them in an individual contributor role, or take them out of the team, and do things that are special for that individual, both of which allow that person to get away with bad behavior. Sort of like, you know, a kid is having a tantrum in a grocery store, and she wants a lollipop, so mom or dad gives her a lollipop to shut them up. That's exactly what's happening. So one of the first strategies is to look to yourself. Am I a toxic buffer doing all these things to buffer them from other people, or am I a toxic protector because I have a special relation with them? Here's the strategy. These individuals are particularly open to feedback. So subsequently, one of the first strategies is rather than going to the toxic person, looking around to see if there's anybody that supports their behavior and giving feedback to them, and often they're relieved. So that's the first strategy. Now let's talk about the strategy about if you're going to give feedback to a toxic person. By the way, the number one question that I get in my work is, how do I give feedback to a toxic boss? That's the number one question. So first of all, there are three types of individuals that I talk about in my book that are toxic. One could be the toxic direct report, so you're the boss of the individual. The second is the toxic peer. And the third is the toxic boss. All have a different strategy, but let me give you the high point of each. Or if the person is a direct report, one of the things that you want to do is not focus on the why of their behavior. Because if you focus on the why, they're going to talk about intent, how they are justified in doing this. The first thing you want to do is talk about their behavior concretely, behaviorally specifically, what you see as the impact of the behavior, and how you want that individual to change, and what are the consequences if he or she does not. By the way, one of the number one strategy that allows people to get away with even the best of feedback is if you don't have consequences. Now let's talk about the peer. The peer strategy is really difficult because this is a person who works beside you. And one of the strategies with a peer is to recognize that it's a difficult conversation and to talk about your perception of how that person's behavior impacts your work, and then invite them into the discussion. For the toxic boss, the key strategy here is to talk with the boss that it is a difficult conversation for you, and that you are committed to the organization. Because of your commitment to the organization, you would like to express some of the thoughts about how he or she could improve their behavior. Threatening. One of the fascinating discoveries that I have found is that often with toxic bosses, more than one individual is impacted by their behavior. And when I coach these individuals, I say, tell me what you did. They go in one-on-one. I say, no. Go in as a group or as a team saying, this is really bothersome. Yes, it's ganging up on the individual. And one of the concerns that people have is, you know, will I be fired? Well, one-on-one, you could be. But going as a team, there's power in numbers. So that's one of the key strategies for giving feedback to your boss.
Well, what about Well, first off, the name of your book again and how people can get it?
Yes. Why Don't Work Here Anymore? And then the subtitle is A Leader's Guide to Offset the Financial and Emotional Cost of Toxic Employees. All you have to do is remember Why Don't Work Here Anymore. Go to any Amazon has it, Goodreads has it, Barnes & Noble. On Amazon, you'll see all 26, 27 reviews and what people are saying about the book.
Well, then, now having said that, my question is, and my difficulty always been dealing with these toxic individuals who are my bosses. In fact, at one point, I had to actually go in and tell him if he looked at his nails once more talking to me, I'd break each of his fingers. it worked. He never looked at his fingers again. Of course, I was out of the company in 3 months. But I was reminded of that.
You're a strong individual. Imagine someone who doesn't have that kind of ego strength that you obviously do. And that's why I say one of the key strategies is to think about going in numbers. And it's amazing. 95% of people don't do that. And it's a no-brainer for me. It's powerful.
Well, Dan, I'm going to turn it back to you. We've got about five minutes, and I don't want to waste a single moment because this is such a great conversation.
Yeah, it is. It is. So, where do you find is there any particular industry or segment that has a higher percentage of toxic workers than others?
Well, that's a great question. I get that often, and the answer is no. But I can tell you the number one industry that has done more than anything on this is healthcare. The Joint Commission is the association that accredits hospitals, and they now have a guideline. In order to have accreditation, every hospital must have a process for dealing with, and listen to this, any behavior that impacts patient safety. So, no. First of all, they're pervasive in all industries, but the industry that has done more than any other is healthcare. You know, speaking of healthcare, here's another, I think your listeners would love this story. I was doing a keynote address, and I was talking about the perils of toxic behaviors, and one toxic behavior is perfectionism, where they micromanage to the point that they're driving you crazy and they're really ruining some of the work. And a surgeon said, Mitch, let me ask you this question. Do you want to go to a surgeon who isn't perfect? And I said, doctor, I want to go to a surgeon if he or she is about to make a mistake, someone feels confident enough to call them on that mistake rather than let them make the mistake because they're fearful of the outcome. What if I call them on that and I'm wrong? I could possibly lose my job. And there was utter silence in this room of 400 people. So it impacts patient safety. It impacts finances. It impacts our personal well-being. I mean, we need to start creating places of respectful engagement. And the term that I talk about in the book is everyday civility. You know, we need to start thinking of how do we create a culture of everyday civility. And one of the ways we do it is one behavior at a time. And it's no longer just about being nice. Sometimes when you have to give performance reviews, you have to give bad news. And I'm not saying be nice. I'm saying be honest and genuine in what you're doing as a leader, what you're doing as an employee.
Please, your book again, one more time.
Yes, my book again, Why I Don't Work Here Anymore, subtitled A Leader's Guide to Offset the Financial and Emotional Cost of Toxic Employees. All you have to do is remember why I don't work here anymore. Amazon, Goodreads, Barnes & Noble, see all the reviews on Amazon.com.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit costs. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. Now it's time to bring together our two experts, Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella, as they discuss things that are happening now that are affecting your business success.
Dan, our next guest is Ken Cooper, founder of CooperCon. I like the name. He's here to talk about harassment in the workplace and Cooper's 8 offender stereotypes. It's a tool which divides harassment into two parts, studs and sneaks. Ken, I absolutely love that, and I really look forward to hearing more about it. But first, tell us a little bit about yourself, about your company, and how you came to be so knowledgeable in this area. And welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on. My background, I'm a stand-up corporate trainer. So I put on seminars, training seminars for businesses and have been doing so for a very long time. And I was, decades ago, I was back doing assertion training seminars. And back when soft skills were very important for businesses, and the audience I had at a large company, I was doing the non-exempts, and they're all primarily women, and they would bring up these situations. And so the discussion of harassment became kind of an eagerly looked forward to part of the seminar. And over time, we started to develop patterns, and I ended up writing a book on it called Stop It Now, How Targets and Managers Can End Sexual Harassment. And I also have a book on body language, so those two were very closely meshed. And I began to categorize what I heard and started training people on the soft skills, the behavioral skills around sexual harassment. So that's how it all began. Hundreds of seminars and tens of thousands of attendees later, the techniques have been pretty much validated.
Well, I'm going to ask you, our newspapers and media are being overwhelmed with all of these harassment stories. Our politicians are being driven from office. But is it more frequent today, or is it just being publicized more today?
Well, in my estimation, there's no change. It's not an epidemic that suddenly popped up. It's just never gone away. I mean, if you think back to the late 80s with the Clarence Thomas case, remember with Anita Hill? If you think of Wilbur Mills and the Tidal bombshell situation, you think of a couple of presidential candidates that were caught doing things they shouldn't and had to drop out. I mean, what's been going on and what's been publicized, oh, it's been around forever. So it's just that people are more willing to speak up about it, even though the regulations and laws have been in place since 1981.
Well, a question is, and here I'm going to get into dangerous territory, but what the heck? But, we hear harassment, but I had a police chief in East Orange many years ago say that much of harassment was breach of promise, and that a lot of things that happened were involved really that the expectation on one side or another, on both sides for that matter, were different, and that at the end, when things had ended badly, you had these various cases. Is that an invalid or invalid statement, or can you expand on it?
Sure. What we're really talking about, are two different things. So official sexual harassment, the kind that's forbidden under the Civil Rights Act and Title VII, is a workplace situation. So there's a big difference today in some of the stories we hear of what I call men behaving badly versus workplace sexual harassment. So if a comedian invites a woman up to his room and expects sex to take place and the woman wants a relationship, as happened to a famous stand-up comedian, that's men behaving badly. And that's a disconnect in terms of what they expected. But in a harassment situation at work, it's some sort of coercive relationship that has a negative effect on the target. So that's a little bit different than perhaps what the police chief was talking about. You know, in the police environment, it would be, there was a case, for example, where the officers would go, all the interrogation rooms had TV, and if someone was going to be searched, a woman was going to be searched, they'd all run over to the TV and watch and make comments. Well, you know, that found its way into the courts and was found to be harassment because it was workplace harassment, different, let's say, than a criminal situation that somebody might have run into. Does that help separate the two?
I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to turn it over to Dan. To me, this is a fascinating subject.
Well, I agree. It's a fascinating subject. And Ken, thank you for joining us today. I'd like to start off my session with playing perhaps devil's advocate with you.
Okay.
I'm going to respectfully disagree with your premise that it hasn't changed much. And the reason I'm going to disagree with you is that I think that there is one thing that has changed dramatically over the last, let's say, 4 to 6 decades, and that is the deterioration of the moral compass of what is acceptable behavior sexually. The increasing number of people who are living together, not married. The amount of sexual activity. I was at a conference yesterday morning where the woman was talking about sexual activity in the United States, and that 15 years ago there were 5 sexually transmitted diseases. Now there are 50 strains. Strangely enough, she said about 45 of them more adversely affect women than men. And so we have a society where sex has become very open, very public, whether it's in television or on the movie screens or in the music. And so that whole structure of what is appropriate behavior in many different facets of our life has deteriorated. So I do think there have been some very significant changes in our society that may have be reflective in what happens between the hormones between men and women. And I'd like to have your thoughts on that.
Well, certainly society has changed, and certainly what's acceptable in public and acceptable in the movies, acceptable on TV, acceptable socially in terms of relationships is very different. There's no question about that. But, you know, I always like to use the example of the presidents. You know, and people talk about, well, you know, men have been behaving badly lately. Well, if you go back through the various presidents, you can start with Roosevelt, and he had his mistresses. Then you go to Eisenhower. He had his driver, Kay Summersby. You know, you work your way up through President Kennedy, was renowned as a womanizer. Work your way on up, Johnson, and so on, all the way up into more modern times. If anything, maybe it's been less. You know, you can probably go through history and people, men behaving badly primarily, has been around a long time. So I think this idea of one person exhibiting power over the other, which is what harassment is, I think that's been around forever in one shape or another. If anything, I think it's the ascendance of women in the workplace that have made it come out more, because women are now in more positions of authority, find themselves into jobs they weren't in those past decades, and therefore it's taken a while for society to adjust to the fact that, hey folks, the women are in the workplace, they're here to stay, then why can't we just treat everybody equally, and why does there have to be this power game going on? It really doesn't have a place in the workplace. So my feeling is, actually, in the decades that I've been at work at it, I haven't seen any difference.
Okay. So if we look at what's going on today, I'm curious, when there is a movement, social, political, whatever it is, in our country, back in speaking of history, we can usually go back to a particular person or an event that changed the paradigm. Is there a seminal event that you think changed in the last year or two that changed the whole public persona of what's going on between men and women?
I think that targets, and I don't like to use the word victim, so I tend to use the word offender and targets, because the target could be a man or a woman. I think targets are more open now to speak out. And so one of the characteristics of a harassment situation that's been fascinating with all these public stories is when an incident comes out, somebody finally comes forward and says, you know what, so-and-so has been harassing me, invariably other targets come out of the woodwork. And you see lots of people saying, me too, me too, me too. And so that's where that came from. But it's true. When you investigate one of these in a business, you find almost no problem validating what happened, because it's happened to a lot of people. And the reason is, for the offender, it's a pattern of behavior. It's not how they treat one person. It's how they treat everybody. It's how they treat all women. And therefore, when one person comes forward, the rest suddenly say, you know what, we've all been treated that way by this person. And you can verify it just by the sheer numbers. And so in almost every single case, we've seen exactly that pattern happen. And that's, I think, part of what's happening, too. People are just more willing to finally come forward with the feeling that, you know what, something's really going to be done this time about it.
Dan, I'd like to jump in here on two things. You say things are expected to be done. I've been a reporter for a long time, and I've gone through, ironically, you even mentioned Wilbur Mills, and there aren't too many people that remember him and Fannie Flagg. But in all these cases, we've had these events appear, and then the media gets tired of covering it, or the public gets tired, and we go back to the same old thing. Do you think that's going to happen here today?
I think perhaps we've hit a milestone in terms of what is acceptable and not acceptable behavior, not only in public but in business. I think everybody's on notice at this point that there can be severe ramifications. And again, we're dealing many times with just things that have been publicized, but for example, the Steve Wynn situation, you know, that indeed what you do can have profound effects on you, no matter how high you are in the organization. And that's something that hasn't been true in the past. At a certain level in the executive suite and above, you could pay somebody to go away, and then that was that. And so that's not working anymore.
Well, you know, in the New York Times Sunday section, this was a major story about Mary Cunningham AG. And her relationship with the chairman of Bendix Corp. If her audience doesn't know, it was probably one of the first cases of a paramour being advanced by a powerful corporate leader that really became widely known. She said in the piece that she's suffering repercussions from it even today. I just wondered your thoughts on that.
Well, one of the questions that always comes up when you talk about sexual harassment is people say, well, what about women harassing men, or what about reverse harassment, or what about, you know, that going on? So that's one issue here. And the other issue is the idea of consensual relationships in business. So we'll do those one at a time. So the first thing is there's four scenarios that can happen in harassment. It can be male harassment of a female, which is by and large the vast majority of cases. A lot of people say, what about female harassment of males. Well, it turns out that's less than 1% in the studies. About 0.6% of the cases are reverse harassment, where a female harasses a male. Second most likely to happen is male harassment of another female, or excuse me, another male. So same-sex, male same-sex harassment of a male, that's second. Third is female same-sex harassment of another female. And fourth, if ever, is female harassment of male. So a lot of people are very surprised at that, that, you know, while people like to ask about it, it's not really the issue. It's actually male harassment of either male or females is the vast majority of all cases you'll see. So that's one thing. Second thing is the idea of, well, what about a consensual relationship? A lot of marriages start for people having met at work. So, you know, the EOC has no restrictions legally on consensual relationships at work. What they do suggest is if you're in the same reporting chain, there's an implied conflict of interest. So it's up to you to notify your boss or your management, hey, someone who reports to me, we now have a personal relationship, and try to remove that conflict of interest. So those are the kind of things that, while they're not legal, are often written into a company's policy that says, look, if you're going to date a subordinate, you just got to let us know so we can remove the coercive nature of it should you break up, and then you still are working with each other, boss to subordinate. So I think a little bit of both of those things was happening in the situation you just mentioned.
Well, I'm going to one more question, turn it back to Dan, which is, since this program aims at small business, what are there differences in small businesses that you've seen, or anything that a small business leader should look at? Can you kind of focus a little bit on small business?
Absolutely. In fact, I owned a company for 10 years, an online training company. We had 26 employees, and all but four were women. So we both trained on it, and we understood what the situation was. So just legally, if you have over 15 employees, you're subject to the federal guidelines. So even a small business has the same rules as does the giant multinational in terms of the legalities. So you need to have a policy in place. It needs to be part of your policy manual. You need the notice up on the wall. Everybody has to be informed as to what the complaint procedure is. Any complaint has to be investigated with what's called a best practice approach, meaning you've got to do it as good as you can. And depending on where you are geographically, for example, California has some additional rules and things you have to do in terms of contact time of training and also the discussion of bullying and so on. So you know, based on where you are as a small business, talk to your legal advisor, talk to your labor advisor. You have the same kinds of responsibilities a large business does.
Dan, back to you.
I want to go back to the blurb that they sent us where you you talk about 8 offender stereotype tools which divide harassment into 2 overreaching categories, studs and sneaks. Can you talk about studs and sneaks?
Absolutely. So where this came from is the targets of harassment in our seminars early on were having trouble describing what happened to them and conveying that to management. So you know, they might go to their supervisor and say, look, you know, Bob puts his hands all over me. I'm just tired of it. Make him stop. And the manager would typically say something like, listen, Bob's just friendly. He doesn't mean anything by it. Come on, don't be so sensitive, and send the target on their way. So what we found is we needed to do 2 things. We needed a 1, culturally in an organization, you've got to establish that harassers are losers. Somebody who sexually harasses a woman is a loser. And by that I mean, just take a bar. You walk up to a woman in a bar and say, can I buy you a drink? Or you ask a coworker out, hey, would you like to have dinner some night? And the coworker says no. All right. So the average person says, okay. The average man says, all right, you know, I asked, no, move on. There's 3.7 billion women in the world. Somebody out there is going to like me. I'll just find somebody who likes me instead of pushing myself on someone who doesn't want to be with me. So the idea that you're pushing yourself on someone who doesn't want to be with you or date you or whatever is loser behavior. So you need to establish that. So what we did is we set up and we began to hear patterns, and we gave them very insulting names, like the Neanderthal or the God's gift to women, so that now a target could go up and say, listen, God's gift to women, and then we added that there's six levels of harassment. He's giving me level three harassment. Now, that's a language that means something. Everybody's been through the training. They know exactly what that is. It's called pinpointing the behavior, and so now you can describe what's going on. So there were really two types. The studs were the folks that thought they were cool and weren't, and the sneaks were the ones that, came at you like they were nice, and it turned out that they were really no different than the studs. For example, a false mentor. You know, you go to somebody and you think, oh, here's somebody who's helping me with my career. And the answer is no, they're just trying to get you in bed just like everybody else. So with some of the famous cases, that's been the case, where people would go to these well-established executives or stars thinking that they were going to receive help, only to find out that they were just trying to get them in bed.
The question that we've had a number of people on our program on variations of this particular theme, and a question I asked them is that a recent study that I saw shows that, as crazy as it sounds, more and more men are turning to robots for relationships. And I'm wondering what, with all of this activity, what it's doing to the ultimate male-female relationship. And has it changed to the point? I mean, we have a problem in this country. Forget about sexual harassment for the moment. We have a problem is that the birth rate in this country is not equal to the death rate. And so that we are diminishing in population. And that's true in Europe, it's true in Asia, it's true in many places of the world. And so if we have people that are reluctant to get married, and they may live together or they may not live together, they just don't want to get married, we're not generating enough children to replace those people that are dying, which means our country is shrinking. I'm wondering if the pressure, and I think this is the right word, the sexual harassment pressure concern is so overreaching that a lot of young men are saying, screw it, I'm not going to bother with it. I'm going to drink it with my buddies and walk away from potential relationships with females. And so in that case, don't both sides actually lose?
You know, I can't speak to the research on population growth. It's just not an area that I research. But let's talk about what you're saying in terms of the workplace again. And so a lot of men will come back and say, well, this is just making it impossible to have a normal relationship with a woman in the workplace now. I'm just too afraid of doing something wrong. You get kind of an angry pushback saying, oh, you're just, you know, screwing things up. And now I can't be normal the way I am. And that's usually pretty easy to beat through, because I always ask the question, you know. So, for example, somebody will say, well, so I put my hand on somebody's shoulder. You know, what's the problem with that? So I touch somebody on the back. I mean, big deal, a woman on the back. Why is she upset about that? And what they're really saying is, I can't interact with you as a coworker unless I put my hands on you. And for most women, they don't want to be pawed. They don't want anybody to put their hands on them. They don't like it. And so there's no reason to do it. And I'll ask him, I say, well, the men that you paw and put your hands on, how do they react? And they'll say, well, I don't do it to men. So I'll explain, well, so you're telling me you don't actually have to put your hands on somebody to work with them. You just do it for women. Is that right? And that's what I think I just heard you say. And so the point is, there's dating behavior and there's work behavior. It's not hard to separate the two, but a lot of men can't. They try to take dating-based behavior and put it back in the workplace. And so for touching, for example, in my body language book, I talk about it. There's zones of touching that we can and cannot touch each other. But I don't put my hands on a woman. In fact, I don't put my hands on a man for any reason. In business, I shake hands. I've seen a man kill a sales deal with another businessman by grabbing his hand and slapping him on the back. And you can just see the customer tense when that happens because they don't like it. And in fact, in some cultures in America, you put your hands on somebody, you get punched. You know, you see somebody at a bar say, don't put your hands on me, and that's man to man. So I'm just saying there's social behavior, there's work behavior, and it doesn't in any way impact, I think, the relationship between a man and a woman at work, the fact that you treat everybody professionally as coworkers. You're not on a date. You're trying to get some work done. So I don't know. That's all I can really say about it, is I don't think it in any way has to impact the work environment.
I understand what you're saying. I've also read some articles recently where because of the proliferation of charges, and not all of them necessarily sustainable, but the whole level of activity, that in some corporations, senior officers have made it a policy that they will no longer meet with a woman in their office alone. That they must
and
have
they,
somebody
and
else.
They should be fired. They should be immediately fired.
You're going to fire the boss?
Yeah. You immediately fire somebody. That's wrong at about five different levels. And so you can't. That's a legal time bomb waiting to blow up.
Please tell us. That's fascinating because that just happened a Monday at a meeting I was at. You're saying that if the CEO or C-level won't meet with a woman alone, that he should be fired?
Exactly.
Am I hearing that correctly?
Yes. And here's why. Let me go through the various levels, but let's take the big one at the top. So one of the things that you can do to help yourself understand is something harassment or not, is to substitute one of the other protected classes. The Civil Rights Act has these protected classes. We call it RADNADZIP, you know, race, religion, national origin, disability, and so on. Sex is one of them. Gender is one of them. In some states, gender preference, and so on and so on. So let's substitute another protected class for what that person just said. So what if the CEO said, I refuse to be in a room alone with a black person because that lying black person will falsely accuse me of sexual or of racial discrimination, or I'm going to set a policy where I refuse to be in a room with a Jewish person because that lying Jewish person is going to accuse me of religious discrimination. So how would that hold up in terms of a policy? Because sex is a protected class. So when you discriminate only against women, you are violating the Civil Rights Act. You are, in essence, violating the very thing you say you're trying to support, and you're a lawsuit waiting to happen. You're a time bomb. I can't have you working for me. So that's the first thing. Number two, it shows me that you can't logically think through a situation, because who is that third person going to be? If it's another woman, then you now have two people that you wouldn't meet with individually in the room protecting you, supposedly. So that doesn't make sense. So if it's another man, it's one of your cronies, what makes you think that that makes you any more credible and protected from that, quote, false accusation than you are now? The fact that you and your buddy say, oh, it never happened. We didn't do that. And so the logic of it, the actual how you do it, makes no sense whatsoever. So that's another thing that worries me about it. And then number three is, what are you doing with all the protected classes? You know, how is it that avoidance and running away with it is good? And what you're doing, you're destroying any sense of teamwork and camaraderie in your organization, because you're saying all women are untrustworthy. That's the message I'm going to send to my entire organization, that all women are lying SOBs who are going to falsely accuse me unless they're caught at it or kept from doing it. Well, you've just alienated half your workforce, and it's called an engaged workforce. You've just disengaged half your workforce or more. How is that making you productive if that's the attitude you have about your employee, that you're all lying cheaters that I have to watch out for? So on a whole bunch of different levels, if that's my CEO, and I have counseled and coached, I've been on a board of directors of a company and counseled and coached people. I've been on the compensation committee of a CEO, board of directors. Trust me, if somebody said that, as far as I'm concerned, they just qualified themselves from the job. So that's a dumb thing to do if you're a business person.
Go ahead,
we're talking with Ken Cooper. Ken, how do people reach you and find your company?
Easiest way is my website, stopshnow.com, stopshnow.com.
Okay. We've been talking with Ken Cooper of CooperCon, who's stunned me a couple of times. I don't know about you, Dan, but... it's just been a fascinating time.
I agree. We'll have him back soon.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.